three times in the last half century, a serious attempt has been made to define who is a Jew. The first attempt was made by our sworn enemies. In the mid-1930s, you recall, the Germans passed the Nuremberg Laws, which decreed that no Jew might be employed by the civil service, enter the law courts, occupy a position on an academic faculty, or in the universities. And of course, with typical German efficiency, the bureaucrats needed to know who is a Jew, who comes under these rules. And of course, the National Socialists had long since determined that a Jew, or the definition of a Jew, had nothing to do with commitment or belonging, but had rather to do with biology. And so they decreed, following a line which had already been set down by Adolf Hitler in his Mein Kampf 2 decades before, that a Jew was simply anyone who had at least one Jewish grandparent. And any number of startled Christians who'd been raised in good Christian homes and baptized and sent to Christian schools suddenly found themselves out of work, and others later found themselves sent to the camps. Now, anti-Semitism has many sources, as you know. There's always a feeling that the stranger, the one who's different from us, is somehow alien and suspect. Unfortunately, the New Testament came into being in a time of competitive religious tensions, and so it includes any number of damning statements about the Jew. And these, of course, achieve the role of being sacrosanct, the Word of God. And then the early church developed the concept of the Jew as the deicide who bears the mark of Cain. It insisted that those who punish the Jew are fulfilling the decision of God himself, God's judgment on the Jew. And the church by the 3rd and 4th century had devised a system of apartheid as rigorous, as complete, as any that the Afrikaners have devised in the Union of South Africa in this century. The Jew was to be set aside. He was to wear distinctive clothing. He was to live in a particular area of the city. He was to be denied employment in most of those types of undertakings which were believed to be wholesome. He was not to be able to enter the guilds. He was a pariah, someone set apart. And then the inevitable superstition and demonology which exists in the depths of the human mind plays a role. But with all of this, one must also add that there was a very practical and common sense basis to anti-Semitism as there is to any prejudice. And that is, if one can create a society in which one's prejudice has the force of authority, one protects oneself from the competition of that group by declaring that the Jew could not enter the legal and the medical profession. The Jew could not compete with the non-Jew. In effect, those who had the license, the privilege, were protected from competition. Now, all that worked fairly well for Christians as long as the world remained as it had been, medieval. But with emancipation, with the emergence of the nation state, with the concept of citizenship, with the idea that there was a common ground on which all individuals who lived in a particular territory could meet, the idea that one could be free of the competition of, in this case, the Jew, on purely religious grounds, became a rather feeble reed to lean on. Because the Jew, the brightest and most modern of them, quickly discovered that religion didn't quite mean what it had meant in the Middle Ages, that one could convert. Heine called his conversion a passport into Europe. And by conversion, all those now purely social, artificial, non-governmental rules of exclusion fell away. There were places, of course, throughout the last century, well into this century, where Jews could not live, where they were not welcome, there were businesses they could not enter, there were boardrooms where they were not accepted. But ultimately, if one converted and ceased to be a Jew, all those barriers had to fall. And so the anti-Semite had to devise a new system, a new definition of the Jew, a non-religious definition. And in the middle and late decades of the 19th century, men like Houston Chamberlain and Gobineau and others devised the concept of race. Being Jewish now became something indelible, something biological. You could not escape being a Jew by conversion. And therefore, they protected themselves and the privileged of Europe from the competition of the bright young Jews who were coming out of the shtetl and out of the ghetto, their minds trained acutely by traditional Jewish forms of learning, who were competing all too successfully with them in so many areas of life. And it is that tradition which the Germans in the middle of the 1930s gave the force of law. Now, after the Second World War, with the establishment of the State of Israel, another government had to begin to define who is a Jew. As you know, the first basic law that was passed by the new state was a law which was called the Law of Return, a law under which anyone who was a Jew would be admitted to Israel as a full citizen automatically. That was the purpose of having a Jewish national home. When, in the days of open immigration, people had come to the United States from Europe, from Asia, and they presented themselves at Ellis Island or its West Coast equivalent, though technically this country was open, there were still restrictions. If you were sick, if you were psychologically infirm, if you were a criminal, you were not admitted. But in Israel was determined every Jew should be admitted. Almost every Jew who lived in Europe had been declared a criminal by the Nazis. And many Jews had been broken in body, if not in mind, by their experience during the Holocaust in the camps. There were to be no barriers. But again, the question that the administrators had to ask is, who is a Jew? Now, according to traditional Jewish law, traditional rabbinic law, a Jew is a person who was born of a Jewish mother or one who has been converted into the faith. But in the process of admission, because of the maelstrom from which these people came, there are obviously many who were non-Jews who were married to Jews. Families had been lost, papers had been lost. It was almost impossible to prove who you were. And so by and large, in those days, the law, and still today, the law of return was applied very broadly. And families of those where one or another of the parents were Jews were simply admitted into the state. Now, there's another element in the traditional definition of a Jew. And it's a rabbinic statement that says that even when a Jew sins, he remains a Jew. And this tradition, which was much debated in the Middle Ages by rabbis who took both sides of the issue, raised the question whether somebody who had converted to another faith was still under the halakha a Jew. There were opinions on the one side and there were opinions on the other side. But as you know, in recent years, under the tremendous pressures of change that have coursed across Jewish life, those who have been responsible in the Orthodox community for the definition of law have tended to be more and more strict, more and more traditional, more and more unwilling to adjust the law to life. And so, by and large, the religious authorities in Israel insisted that the older tradition, that even if one had converted, one remained under the law a Jew. Now, all that was purely theoretical, until a man by the name of Brother Daniel applied for admission to Israel under the law of return. Now, Brother Daniel had been born as a Jew, as a child of Jewish parents in Poland in the late 1930s. And when the Germans had invaded Poland, his parents, trying to save his life, had placed him with nuns in a local nunnery. And his parents had been killed in the camps. The nuns became his family. He was raised in a religious tradition. He was raised in a loving tradition. He grew to love the tradition and of the life of the nunnery and then of the monastery where he was later put. And when he became of age, he took minor orders and he became a monk. And he was sent by he was a Capuchin monk who was sent by his church to Israel to take part in their missionary activities among Jews. And apparently he felt that if he could come into Israel as a Jew under the law of return, it would somehow enable him to be more effective in his work among Jews. It's an early version of the completed Jew, who then says to the rest of the Jews, you can be Jewish and remain. Well, when Ben-Gurion circulated, the chief rabbin at the time, they hemmed and they hawed. They obviously didn't want Brother Daniel to come in as a Jew for these purposes. At the same time, they were timid and scared to take the minority position that had been taken in the Middle Ages, that he did not qualify. And Ben-Gurion rather impatiently then referred the case to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court of Israel ruled that Brother Daniel could be admitted as a citizen to Israel by normal procedures, the way anybody can apply for admission, but he did not qualify under the law of return. The traditional community objected vehemently to this decision, not so much that they were concerned about its practical consequence, but they are very much concerned that the Supreme Court, the law of the land, not have any veto on their powers, which give them complete control of personal status, marriage, divorce, guardianship, adoption, inheritance. Their vision of Israel is as a church state. And obviously, if a secular body, the Supreme Court, can veto their decisions or even judge them to be proper or appropriate or not appropriate, that is a limitation on their power. In any case, that issue simply raised the concerns of the Israeli government about and of Israeli citizens about the definition of who is a Jew. Now, there are two issues that were raised. One had to do with the law of return, and the other had to do with the registration certificate, which every Israeli citizen is required to carry with him. For reasons of security, Israeli citizens, unlike American citizens, must carry with them at all times a card, name, address, all the rest, which has in it a little box which say la'um, nationality or ethnic nationality. For reasons of security, the Israelis want police and security want to be able to stop somebody and know if they're Jew, if they're Druze, if they're Arab, if they're Christian, who they are, so they know whether or not they're to be concerned about them under particular emergency situations. Now, the control and the responsibility for the distribution and the filling in and administration of these cards was given originally to the Ministry of the Interior. And in Israel's peculiar political structure, the control of the portfolio, if you will, of the Ministry of Interior has traditionally been one which is given to a member of the National Religious Party, the Orthodox political religious group. And they were filling in these cards automatically according to the halakha. A Jew was a Jew if you had a Jewish mother or if you had converted according to the law. There was a great deal of discussion of this, although most children of mixed marriages who came to Israel under Aliyah and who settled there and went to Israeli schools and spoke Hebrew and joined the youth groups and the army simply went through, decided to go through a process of conversion and so be accepted. But there was so much concern that in 1958, Ben-Gurion circulated, the leading legal scholars, historians in Jewish life, as to who is a Jew. And there was a great deal of discussion for a year or two on the issue. The traditional scholars, of course, came down with a traditional definition. Some of the historians, some of the non-traditional leaders suggested ways around this difficulty by saying either that the laws of registration of personal and the law of return should be handled in a secular way, leaving aside the laws of personal status. Or they suggested to Ben-Gurion that there had been traditionally a category of people who were close to our community, part of our community, but had never officially converted into our community. We know them from Roman times. They were called the Gerei Toshav, the strangers who are citizens among us. And always they were treated openly and easily by Jewish society. But Ben-Gurion was a complex creature. Himself a lo dati, a confirmed ideological anti-religious socialist, he nevertheless was deeply concerned about the possibility of what he called a Kulturkampf, a religious war in the young state, between people like himself or people of non-Orthodox persuasion and the traditional Jewish community. And he was also convinced that unless the Israeli government adopted the laws of the mandate period in Turkish law, which gave the rule of personal status to the various religious communities, there would not be a principle of continuity and stability which the young state so required. So despite all the suggestions that were made to him, Ben-Gurion simply ordered the Ministry of Interior to continue filling out the forms according to the traditional ruling. But it was not long before a challenge was raised. And the challenge was raised by a young Navy officer in the Israeli Navy by the name of Benjamin Shalit. Benjamin Shalit had two children. He was exactly of the ideological persuasion of Ben-Gurion, except unlike Ben-Gurion, he was not willing to accept to accommodate himself or his children by simply having them go through the forms of a conversion. And when he brought his children to have their registration certificates filled out, he told the registrar, fill them out as Jews. The registrar refused, and Shalit immediately brought a case in the courts, which ultimately found its way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, ruled that the registrar should, in fact, accept whatever profession was made to them by the applicant. And this decision caused such an uproar among the religious parties that they threatened to pull out of the government, to pull down the government. Ben-Gurion and his government then capitulated, and a new law was promulgated, which directed that the registrars for the certificates fill out the forms in this way. If you were obviously of Jewish parents, you were a Jew. If you had a Jewish mother, you were a Jew. If you had converted, you were a Jew. And if you had not become a proselyte, that is, a communicant of another tradition, you were a Jew. So that the Orthodox, the traditional ruling was accepted in all but two ways. They made a ruling which the Orthodox didn't fight too much, that if one had become a proselyte for the laws of registration, he must not be considered a Jew. And secondly, when they defined conversion, conversion was defined without any modifying terms. And this began what has now been a 20-year battle in Israel between the religious groups and others. Because according to the terms which now exist, if someone comes to the temple or to Park Synagogue, to any reform or conservative or reconstructionist congregation, and asks the rabbi of that congregation to undergo a process of conversion, and the rabbi is satisfied with their interests and their concerns, their commitments, and they go through a process of study and then are converted. Now, according to both the law of return and the law of registration, when they get to Israel, if they should make Aliyah, they are to be considered as Jews. They will not be considered as Jews, interestingly, for other matters. That is, when they deal with matters which are controlled by the religious courts, they will not be considered as Jews. So if a married couple here, married, that I have married, where I have converted the woman, which is only the woman that is at issue for the Orthodox, should make Aliyah, and they should come to Israel, and they would raise their children in Israel, and their children would be part of the Israeli school system, they would go into the army. If one of these children should present themselves to the religious courts and say, I'm in love with an Israeli, and we want to get married, the answer will be, you cannot, because you are not Jewish. Because you had a non-Jewish mother. And then you have the alternative of going through a traditional conversion according to the forms of Orthodoxy, or simply leaving the state and being married in Cyprus or someplace else. Because diavad, after the fact, Orthodoxy will accept the idea that a marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew has a certain civil force to it. But for purposes of religious law, it has none. The ruling that the Knesset passed 20 years ago accepted the conversions that are made in the diaspora by those of us who are non-Orthodox, and the Orthodox community has been trying ever since to undo that reservation. So again and again, in almost every Knesset, a law has been introduced which requires that the state register converts only if they are converted kahalacha, according to the law. Now that's the status in Israel. The third attempt to define who is a Jew began some years ago here in the United States. Unlike the two previous definitions, it was not undertaken by a governmental body, not by the Germans and not by the Israelis, but it was undertaken by the Reform Movement. It was undertaken for a number of reasons, most of which had to do with the feeling that the Orthodox community was creating increasing distance between themselves and the rest of us, and that it was necessary for us to say publicly what it is we do and why it is that we do it. And so in the late 1970s, the Reform Movement began to debate the question, who is a Jew? And in 1983, at a conference, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, passed a resolution of which this is the operative paragraph. The conference declares that the child of one Jewish parent is under the presumption of Jewish descent. This presumption of the Jewish status of the offspring of any mixed marriage is to be established through appropriate and timely public and formal acts of identification with the Jewish faith and people. The performance of these mitzvot serves to commit those who participate in them, both parents and child, to Jewish life. What the Reform Movement did by passing this particular rule was to say essentially that the practice which has been the common practice of our movement for the last 100 years is now what we publicly affirm. Long since, for generations, if a mixed marriage couple came to the temple and said, we have talked it through and we've decided we want to raise our children as Jews, we enrolled those children in our religious school, whether the mother was the Jew or the father was the Jew, and we took the child's involvement in the religious school, consecration, bar mitzvah, confirmation, as tantamount to their conversion. They were, in all things, considered to us by us to be Jews, and no questions were raised in terms of marriage or any other of the rules of personal status. And if it was a mixed marriage in which it was the woman who was the non-Jew and the Jewish husband should die, and the non-Jewish wife wanted to remain a member of the temple for the sake of her children, for whatever reason, we kept her on her rolls, and we never asked any questions when it came to burial in our cemetery. That's been the practice for a century or more. And it's been the practice not only of this synagogue, but of all those within our movement. So essentially, the statement does nothing but formulate what has in fact been the common practice. It is based on the recognition that in a world such as ours, a pluralistic world, a world where we are all part of any number of cultures, where intermarriage is, in a sense, inevitable. The making of fixed, rigid divisions, particularly divisions which may have worked well in medieval times, is no longer a particularly useful undertaking. Moreover, when we looked back into our tradition, we discovered that the rule that a Jew is one who is a child of a Jewish mother is not one which was given to Moses on Mount Sinai. As a matter of fact, if you look back in the early reaches of the Bible, you discover quite the opposite. Joseph, when he became the chief minister of Egypt, according to Genesis, is given by the Pharaoh the daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On, a woman named Asenath, to be his wife. Now, there's no indication that she ever converted. Her father was one of the great priests of one of the great Egyptian gods. And interestingly, they had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, who were considered Jewish enough by the tradition to become the progenitors of two of the great 12 tribes of Israel. And if we look down further in our tradition and look at King Solomon, King Solomon is said to have married many foreign wives, and one of these women was an unnamed Amorite woman, no indication that she ever converted. And their son, the son of Solomon and this Amorite woman, was a man named Rehoboam, who became Solomon's successor on the throne of Israel. So in point of fact, if you look back in history, you would find a person being king in Israel, who, according to medieval halakhic law, was not in fact a Jew. We don't know really when this concept that it is the mother, the matrilineal descent, which determines the status of a person came into being. There are some who believe that it came into being around the year 440 before the Common Era, when Ezra, a priest, Judean priest scribe, comes back from Babylon to Jerusalem in order to impose a more rigid priestly discipline upon that community. And he, among other things, he orders a number of men who had intermarried with local women to put away their wives. And there's some belief that since the wives were sent back to their families, apparently took their children with them, this is when the idea that descent follows the mother began to become part of Jewish life. Others believe that it's a century or two later, during the Maccabean Rebellion and then the wars against Rome, the wars of 66-70, the Bar Kokhba Rebellion in the second century, when during times of war there were always great incidents of rape, when a number of Jewish women were raped and the Jewish community wanted to protect the children, to bring them into their own, how whatever had been the cause of their birth, and stipulated that the descent follows the mother in order to make this possible. Whatever be the historic reason, by the 3rd century, the 4th century, it was very clear that in the Talmud the ruling is, if your son is the son of an Israelite woman, he is your son. If your son is the son of a non-Israelite woman, he is not your son. And this has been the accepted tradition by Rabbinic Judaism ever since. Interestingly, the Reform resolution went one step further, because it said that in this day and age when gender ought not to be taken into account, we're not going to create a separation between the presumption of Jewishness of the child of a non-Jewish mother or the child of a non-Jewish father in a mixed marriage. That is, if there is a mixed marriage, the child is considered to have presumptively to be Jewish, that is, destiny does play a role, but only if that presumption is acted upon by the family, by the child, by active participation in Jewish life. Now, it makes no difference, according to this resolution, whether it is the father or the mother who is the non-Jewish partner in this marriage. And one of the criticisms which was raised to this definition is that it unsettles this Jewish status of those who are born of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother, because it raises questions of the status of one who's born of a non-Jewish father and a Jewish mother, because it raises status questions as to their status as Jews. Now, why was this resolution passed? Generally, one ought to avoid definitions. All definitions are dangerous. Definitions are intended to exclude. It was passed, I believe, out of a growing feeling that there was a deliberate attempt being made by the right wing of the Orthodox community to demand that all of Jewish life in a religious sense, religious discipline, conform to their way, and that anything that did not conform to their way was to be set aside and to be damned. Unfortunately, because of the political construction of Israel, where the religious parties are in fact political parties who have tremendous clout because they present the swing vote in terms of Likud or Labor being able to establish governments, these right-wing groups have been able to achieve inordinate amounts of power. And increasingly, they have been imposing their way upon the state, not only in matters having to do with non-Orthodox and Orthodox Judaism. You may have seen in the papers in the last 2 weeks that the Israeli Airlines, El Al, said that it had suffered a $9 million loss this year due entirely to the Orthodox imposed restriction that its planes not fly on the Sabbath. Wherever you look in Jewish life in Israel, there has been an attempt to delegitimize non-Orthodox forms of Jewish life. Some of the Orthodox of the Agudat HaRabbanim put an advertisement in the Israeli papers before the last high holidays, which warned Jews against worshiping in the conservative and Orthodox synagogues in Israel, claiming if they did so, they would be participating in acts of idolatry. So part of this is simply anger, bitter response to what is being imposed upon us and imposed upon well-meaning individuals, innocent individuals in the process. An example. A couple is married here, let's say, in the States. They are divorced. Either the husband or the wife comes to the temple and says, I've met a lovely woman and that marriage is behind me. We want to get married. I marry them. They then decide to make aliyah. They go to Israel, they make aliyah, and they have children. Now, this couple that came to be married were divorced legally in the United States. They may even have received in the process from some reform or conservative rabbi who gives a bill of divorcement, a get. But unless that get had been signed by an Orthodox Beit Din, an Orthodox court, it has no standing in the eyes of the chief rabbinate. And therefore, that first marriage is still in being. The second marriage is a non-marriage, and the children of that second marriage are mamzerim. And if you're a mamzer, which does not mean bastard, by the way, it means somebody who's born out of a marriage which is prohibited by Jewish law. You may not ever marry a Jew. The only person you can marry is another mamzer. And so what you have, in effect, is a medieval law of exclusion which holds up to contempt legitimate actions by decent people who have done all that needs to be done by the laws of the country in which they live and by the practices of the religious community of which they have been a part. I'll give you a comparison. Last week, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the head of the Chabad movement, wrote a letter to his schools in Israel, to the principals of his schools, in which he said that they were not to admit to their schools any of the children who come from Ethiopian Jewry, from the Beta Yisrael, the Farashas, because there is some doubt in some minds, not in all Orthodox rabbis' minds, but in some minds that these people are in fact Jewish. Now here are Jews who have suffered for centuries a martyrdom because they are Jews, who are the remnant of a people who marched thousands of miles to leave their homeland to come to Israel, who are not to be admitted to a Jewish school because there's some kind of medieval doubt as to the status of their Jewishness. Compare that with what has been the liberal attitude for the last century or so. Now, one can make the argument that we should simply have continued to do what we've been always doing. Why did we have to make a pronouncement? And the answer, of course, is that I think the motive power for this resolution came in the growing anger being felt by those in the Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist movements who believe honestly and totally and wholeheartedly in the legitimacy of their Judaism and of the effectiveness of their Jewish activities, who suddenly see themselves as the subject of a process of delegitimization, a concerted process of delegitimization by the right wing, particularly an increasingly important wing of the Orthodox community. And this process is going on across the world. A friend of mine, an English artist, a very fine artist, decided to get married. He has an ascetic sense. He wanted to be married in one of the very old synagogues in London, down in the center of the old city. Beautiful place. Beavis Marks. Beavis Marks is controlled by the United Synagogue, the Orthodox body in England. And suddenly this man, who was a Jew, discovered that he had to get proof that he was a Jew before the Orthodox rabbi would marry him. And the wife, who's also a Jew, he comes from Cleveland originally, she from Akron, had to get proof that they were Jews. I got a desperate phone call. Prove that I'm a Jew. Now, I could have sent across the confirmation certificate of this artist who had been confirmed in one of the local synagogues, but that would not have sufficed. That's no proof. What I had to do in order for him to accomplish what he wanted was to go to one of my friends in the Orthodox rabbinate in Cleveland, who accepted my word that the man was a Jew, and had no idea who he was, and then who signed a certificate to that effect and forwarded it to England so that this particular marriage could take place in this particular way. That kind of deliberate suspicion on the integrity of what the non-Orthodox rabbinate is doing, I think, is the motive power behind this attempt to define. Like all attempts to define, it is a difficult one to really justify. But it does suggest the way in which Reform or Conservative Judaism are going about looking at the problems of the day. But it also suggests one of the great, perhaps the gravest problem which faces the Jewish people. And that is the problem of separation, of separating out. I don't know if you read the letters to the editor which go into the Cleveland Jewish News. But if you do, and you'll see an increasingly strident tone in those letters by members of the traditional community, damning, condemning, demeaning, assuming that what we're doing, what we do here, what was done in any synagogue that's not Orthodox in the city, cannot possibly have any kind of value, that it's always simply a form of assimilation. Some years ago, Shubert Spiro was the rabbi of Young Israel. I've worked very hard in this community to create a sense of community where all the three groups come together. And some 7 years ago, I was able to bring into being what is something unique in American Jewish life, a congregational plenum, which consists of every congregation in this city, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, their rabbi, their president, and a past president. No such body exists anywhere else in the United States. So it's not that we haven't worked very hard to maintain community. And I've tried always to bend over backwards so that sense of community is maintained. Now, I would never be invited to speak in an Orthodox synagogue on anything. Never. Nor would any Reform rabbi, nor would any Conservative rabbi. We are seen in their eyes, or at least the eyes of the simplest among them, as people who are deliberately misleading Jews. But here was a case where I invited Schubert, who's an old friend, to come and speak at the temple, to speak at on rabbinic Judaism was part of an historical history series we were doing that year, his own field. And simply to explain to this congregation its basis, its approach, and so on. He came, and he showed me a week or two later a sheaf of maybe 80 letters he'd received, calling him every name in the book for having been willing to enter a place such as this. He would not have been criticized had he entered a church, but he was bitterly criticized for being willing to come here to defend, to explain, as he could very well, his own positions. Those in the Orthodox community who are willing to go along and to cooperate, who understand that there are many ways in which one can worship and approach God, are increasingly under pressure from the ultra-right wing, particularly in Israel, but flowing also out of Israel to groups in the United States, such as Telstra Yeshiva here, who are increasingly under pressure to cut all the ties, to demand, to insist, but not to cooperate. And the more that happens, a community such as ours, whose numbers are down, which desperately needs united strength, will be weakened in the process. One can argue that the passage of this resolution on who is a Jew by the Central Conference, in fact, was a form of weakening of the ties. But it was a reaction, not an action. And there have been any number of reactions in which we ought to be aware. When a year ago the last attempt was made to change the laws of registration in return to say that only conversions, kahalacha, conversions according to the law, shall be accepted in Israel by the Ministry of Interior, the conservative movement in the United States passed a resolution that any member of the Knesset, any member of who had voted to make the change, should not be invited by that congregation to speak from its pulpit or at any other activity. At the last meeting of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations at their biennial this earlier this month, they passed a demand for the first time that the monies raised through the United Jewish Appeal, which go through the Jewish Agency, shouldn't go only to Orthodox institutions in Israel, but that a proportion of those monies, proportionate to the number of schools and number of communities and number of agencies in Israel, should go to the non-Orthodox institutions, kibbutzim, and schools. Increasingly, the diaspora is saying, Israel, you have a problem. For whatever historic reasons, you've created a church state. Church states are not the way to go in the 20th century. We cannot even go any longer by the way of simple nationality. How many people today have dual nationality? Two passports, sometimes three. Why? Because we recognize that in the turmoil of modern life, it's no longer the case where we're born in a place, rooted to that place, remain in that place, where birth, destiny determine all that we are. And what is true in terms of nationality is al achat kama v'chama, how much the more so true in matters of religious tradition. We need flexibility. We need openness. In many ways, it would be better in Jewish life if we never tried to define. We simply went along and talked of belonging, commitment, training up, Jewish identity, all those things which are so important. But unfortunately, for the moment, things are moving in the other direction. And they're being impelled by unreconstructed medievals among us, who are using the leverage given to them by the Israeli political system to sow disruption and disunity in Jewish life. And Jewish life, God knows, cannot afford it. We need whatever united strength we have to be able to survive. I don't know if the liberal way is the right way. I don't know if the traditional way is the right way or the conservative way is the right way. I know which way is right for me, and you know which way is right for you. And the truth of the matter is that in the 20th century, in the era of pluralism and democracy, all of us, of every brand of commitment, must learn to live and to let live. Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. This and that can equally be the way to interpret the words of God. Amen.